From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. For Janet Levine, life in South Africa was a paradox. She was a white liberal who opposed apartheid, but she knew by being white she was nonetheless part of the system. On today's Fresh Air, Levine tells us how she dealt with this paradox through political activism, then self-exile. Also today, Jane Kramer talks about seeing Europe as an American and America as a European. Kramer writes the Letter from Europe column in the New Yorker magazine. And we have reviews of the new rock album from the band Sonic Youth and of the new movie Dangerous Liaisons. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. What do you do if you are a white liberal living in South Africa? You're in revolt against the system of racial oppression, yet you are part of that system because as a white you are part of the privileged minority in power. This was the basic question that led Janet Levine to make some pretty tough choices in her life. Levine is a liberal white South African. She opposed apartheid through her work as a student activist, journalist, and member of the Johannesburg City Council. Her political mentor was Helen Sussman, the liberal member of parliament. Levine was also a founding member of the first black-owned business cooperative in South Africa. But in 1984, Levine came to the conclusion that the white liberal was no longer relevant in the battle between black nationalists and the white racist government. She moved with her family to Boston, where she now lives in self-exile. She's written a new memoir titled Inside Apartheid. I asked Janet Levine to elaborate on the paradox she faced as a white liberal in South Africa.
It's very apparent that because one is white in South Africa, one lives the type of lifestyle that is impossible at this stage for blacks to live. One has privilege, one has access, one has freedom of movement within the bounds of the limits the government imposes on everyone. One has a modicum of freedom of speech. For instance, I was allowed to get up on platforms and say things that a black activist would be not allowed to say, would simply have been removed and put into detention. So from that point of view, to blacks, white liberalism is not an understood phenomenon. And then being black, any black person is part of the oppressed, and therefore an activist, just simply by being black, just by the daily sort of life that a black person has to lead, they are part of the repression, part of the oppression, and therefore part of the political dynamic. So I'm not black. I couldn't be part of that type of oppression. But being white, I had to make a choice to choose to be an activist liberal. And that is the paradox. And most whites don't understand that either.
Don't understand why you oppose the system?
Correct. And the party that I represented, the Progressive Federal Party, which had a long history of being a human rights liberal party, it was often a paradox to me to go into people's homes and canvass them for their votes, you know, being whites being the only people allowed to vote, and really be saying to them, vote for us and we're going to give away your prestige and your access and your privilege. So, you know, there is that paradox.
Were there actions that you would take in the course of a regular day that would make you feel like you were indeed complicit with the system?
Only in that, you know, every minute of the day I was aware that I was living in a white suburb, that I had access to transport that black people wouldn't have. That if, for instance, if I went into a store, that automatically the person behind the counter would turn to me before a black person to serve me. That sort of daily type of living. But I was very aware of, in the broader sense, of, you know, trying very hard not to be complicit with the system.
You say that as the government thought of you as a danger to the state, black activists thought of you as a white liberal and therefore irrelevant. Did you ever feel that white liberals were irrelevant to changing apartheid?
Yeah, that was the sad sort of resolution I came to shortly before I resigned in 1984 from public office. I felt that the sweep of history had moved very much towards a clash between black nationalists and white nationalists, and that in a way the liberals and the credo of liberalism was merely building the bridges that a type of revolution was needed to totally sweep away and just put into motion a change, a total change in the society. So I just felt that those white liberals like myself who held positions in government bodies were giving credibility to the lie that, in fact, there was some type of democratic practice in South Africa. And it was apparent to me that for a long time I was able to do quite a lot, especially using the media and getting the word out in the international press and to other South Africans, calling the government to account, putting on record trying to get them to answer why they had produced such and such a law. But once censorship became a real problem for the media, even that access disappeared. And it just seemed to me that being in a government body, I was helping to prop up apartheid. The ground had disappeared, that ground from which I could operate.
Was there a turning point for you where you reached that conclusion?
I think it had been a gradual process since 1976 with the first so-called riots of the children in Soweto. It became very apparent to me then with my dealings with the children and with adult Sowetans and my work on a black newspaper subsequent to that, that the mood amongst blacks themselves had changed. And I began to realize that, in fact, the dynamic in South Africa was going to be, the government had structured it in such a way it was inevitable, there was going to be a white nationalism, black nationalism clash. And that the whole political movement had swung towards black activism and revolution and away from a type of inculcation of human rights.
Were you thinking, I'm sorry, go ahead.
So I think that's the point. And then in 1984, when the government came up with a new constitution that made it constitutionally impossible for blacks to be enfranchised, that to me was the ultimate turning point.
Did you start to feel that whichever won, the black nationalist or the white nationalist, that there'd be no room for you in South Africa?
Yes, I did. I did feel that. There are a number of liberals who worked alongside me for many years who don't feel that. Some of them have swung to the right and have actually voted for the government because they also, in a sense, sensed what I did, that there has been this movement, this split in the society that's becoming more and more divisive. And there are many white activists who have moved into more type of revolutionary grassroots movements. I still think that in the long run, it is a black struggle. And the whites who go along with it are really fellow travelers as opposed, they're not black. And I think that in the end becomes the vital point.
My guest is Janet Levine, and she's written a new memoir titled Inside Apartheid, One Woman's Struggle in South Africa. When you made your decision to enter politics, you knew in a way that meant operating within a white-only world, since the world of politics was really closed to blacks.
I think, I'm a self-confessed political junkie. And being that, I knew that I wanted to be involved in all the excitement that politics brings, the challenges and the opportunities. I also knew that I don't think that I'm of the material of which martyrdom is made. So the option for a white activist is either to go into a type of party political situation, which I did, or to move to the ranks of the revolutionary movements with the very strong possibility of having to go to prison or to be in detention or to be banned or exiled or any one of the other government created repressions. And, I just did not choose to do that. I am not a martyr. I just didn't see the value of serving time at the government's behest.
Was it hard to get elected as a liberal?
Yes, it was always a struggle, and it was always dubious. One never quite knew what external events would change people's minds. The area that I represented had, for many, many years, voted for Helen Suzman on the parliamentary level. I represented the area that she represented on the Johannesburg City Council. It was a continual battle. One had to keep going back to voters. One could never really rely on the majority of people in the area voting for one.
What kinds of people served on city council with you? Were they mostly upholders of apartheid and very conservative?
Yes, Johannesburg is the biggest urban area in South Africa, and the majority of my fellow councillors were Afrikaner nationalists. And yes, they ranged from conservative to ultra-conservative. And the ones I really were the most suspicious of and disliked the most were those who dressed up in their Gucci suits and had this urbane outer composure, but inside were really die-hard reactionaries.
What do you think was the most dangerous and outrageous decision that city council made while you served?
I think the whole handling of the strike of 10,000 municipal workers in July 1980 could have led to, it didn't, but it could have led to just a major bloodshed in the streets of Johannesburg. So I think that the way that was handled was the most dangerous decision that they made.
What was the time that you felt most effective on city council?
During that same strike, I really felt that for the first time I was able to use the media and to use the press in the way that one of the great human rights precepts that I really still believe in so strongly, you know, the freedom of the press, I was able to use the media to really move events in a way that is just impossible without even a moderately free press.
How were you treated by your fellow city council members? Did they see you as a traitor because you wanted to undermine white power in the country?
Well, I was one of a group of 18 representing my party, the PFP, the Progressive Federal Party. And within our ranks, there was also a range from what I call Tammany Hall placaters to a few outrageous people like myself. So even within the ranks of my own party, I was often accused, in fact, of being a traitor, of wanting to sell the whites out. And certainly there was no coming together on any ground with my opposition, who were the proponents of apartheid.
I'm interested in what it was like to grow up in South Africa and to gradually become aware of what apartheid meant and to gradually start to oppose it. Did your parents support the system?
My parents were studiedly apolitical. They did not feel it safe for whites, particularly middle-class whites and Jewish white South Africans, to be involved in politics. They just felt that we should live our lives, keep our blinkers on, and get on with it. So, to answer your question, no, they were not political.
You had black servants when you were growing up,
as
I guess most of the whites in suburbs did and do. You tell a very interesting story about when you were 8 years old and you were staying at your aunt's house for a while, and one of her servants was pregnant, and she had taken off for her birth, and the servant's baby died in childbirth. And tell what happened after that.
Well, the way I remember it is that we were sitting on the veranda one afternoon having tea, and this particular maid walked past the bottom of the garden wall. We could just see her head. And my aunt exclaimed and stood up and went down to the driveway to talk with her. And she asked the maid how come she'd come home so soon, because she'd had leave for a month or 2 months. I can't remember exactly. And this had been just a couple of days after the maid had given birth. And the woman said that her baby had died and that she needed the money because she wanted to come back to earn more money because there'd been these extra costs of the funeral, and that was why she was back so soon. And I was standing next to my aunt, and I just remember looking at this woman, and what particularly struck me were how scuffed her shoes were, and she sort of walked with a real defeat and a weight hanging on her shoulders, and yet her face was really quite composed and, in a way, very calm. And my aunt had pressed her about details about how the baby died, and she had just been very matter-of-fact that he'd stopped breathing and so on. And she proceeded round to the back of the house, and I went with my aunt to sit down to finish our tea. And she turned to me and she said, you know, those blacks, they just don't feel the same way that we do. And I just remember being absolutely thunderstruck, because I just knew, just looking at that woman and her whole demeanor, that she was just devastated by the death of her baby. So I think it was just incidents like that, when I really searched my memory, that pinpoint for me a sort of realization of stereotyping and inadvertent almost racism.
You spent so much of your adult life in South Africa working against the apartheid system. I was wondering what it was like in your own family, if you would get into arguments with your aunt or with your parents about apartheid.
Right. I think I was a bit young with my aunt. I mean, just the realization that flooded over me at that point, I didn't understand myself and wasn't able to articulate. But certainly later, when I was very drawn to the whole liberal sort of dynamic and wanted to be part of that, yes, I had really strong, strong arguments with my parents, who knew quite rightly that any number of students and activists were all the time just constantly being detained or having their passports taken away or being put under banning orders. And of course, they were very fearful that the same thing would happen to me. So that was the one aspect. They were very afraid for me. The other aspect is that we certainly didn't agree on the whole, all the things that I believed in. They really did not feel, like most other white South Africans, they just did not feel that blacks were in any way ready to be part of a government. And, you know, and I, for whatever reason, and that's something I really try to examine in the book, I just never saw it that way. I just saw blacks as other people and knew that given the equal opportunity, that everybody could work together.
I want to talk with you more about your life in South Africa, but first we're going to take a short break. Janet Levine is my guest, and she's written a memoir about her life in South Africa titled Inside Apartheid, One Woman's Struggle in South Africa. We'll be back after the short break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Janet Levine's new memoir is her account of how she wrestled with this question, how do you oppose apartheid as a white liberal in South Africa? She was a student activist, a journalist, and a member of the Johannesburg City Council. In 1984, she became disillusioned with her ability to change the system. She left South Africa. She now lives in self-exile in Boston, and her new memoir is titled Inside Apartheid. What was your first encounter with black life in South Africa outside of talking to the servants in your family?
The first instance that I can remember is going into one of the townships around Johannesburg called Alexandra, or commonly known as Alex, which is a really deprived and depressed township. They all are, but this one is particularly grim. And in Alex, there was a creche or a daycare center where a friend of mine's mother, I was about 15, 16, and my friend's mother was working with a group of women activists who call themselves the Black Sash. And she was they used to support this creche, and she was the liaison person. And I went with her and my friend into the township. And, not only was the first time I was meeting a black person on a basis other than a servant, a master-servant relationship, but it was the first time I'd actually seen a black township. And I remember just being devastated. We got to this creche, and there were all the little kids outside were snotty-nosed and running around in torn clothes. But inside, they were all neatly dressed with little pinafores and just drinking huge mugs of milk. And I met the woman in charge, the supervisor, who was the first black person who I had seen in a position of authority. And you know, she certainly came across as an efficient person running the creche. I remember it did not seem strange to me at the time. So I don't think that I had really thought that black people should only be servants. You know, it just wasn't a strange phenomenon to me.
Let me ask you, I'm curious, when you were in city council and when you were working against apartheid, were there servants in your family?
Yes, we always had domestic servants, both in my parents' household and in my own.
How did you... I mean, since you opposed apartheid, how did you handle having servants? And were you able to establish a different kind of relationship with them?
Yes, I hope the latter is correct. It's certainly one of those complex issues in South Africa. The unemployment need amongst black people is so enormous that the bush telegraph system gets going if there's a household without a servant. And I literally mean this, you have an endless stream of both men and women coming to your front door asking for work. Any work, can we trim the garden, can we paint your roof, you know, but will you take us on into the household? When I'm talking about unemployment, it really is rife. And because so many categories of jobs are closed to black people, and because the training for blacks is of the nature that it is, domestic service is one of the sort of easier avenues in which to gain employment. So one has to rationalize, well, you know, I'm employing someone who otherwise wouldn't be employed. I will try to make the relationship the best possible one that we can have within the circumstances. And I really do hope that the woman who worked for me, with whom I remain in constant letter contact at the moment, that we did work out a relationship. It was certainly satisfactory from my point, and I do hope that she says she does, so I do hope she means when she says what she says, that it was a good relationship for her too.
Mm-hmm.
And she was wonderful with my children. All the time that you know, I was running around waving banners and giving speeches, both she and my mother-in-law and my mother were there to look after the children. And, you know, I meet many professional women now in the United States who are faced with very much the same question. If they want to pursue an active career, who are they going to have to look after their children?
I'll tell you something I've never understood about the white master black servant relationship in South Africa, since so many of the whites in South Africa really fear blacks and think that they are racially inferior to whites. Why do they feel so comfortable then having black people bring up their children? It seems like such a contradiction.
I think it is a contradiction. I think South Africa is a land of contradictions. I don't think many whites, and I say this advisedly, as I have done in many different occasions, that whites don't necessarily see blacks as people. They're seen, you know, people in the sense of themselves, they're individuals. They're seen either as my domestic servant, my gardener, the person who brings the tea around in the office, and so on. And it's just easier to say, well, I know so-and-so knows me and I know so-and-so, you know, he's a good black or she's a good servant, and just to rationalize it that way so that element of fear is removed. It's no longer a black face or someone potentially part of a threatening black mass. It's simply Maria who works in the kitchen, and you know, she's there as part of the I don't want to say the word furniture, but I've actually heard people say that to me. Maria belongs in this house just as this and that and the other does.
Was it difficult for you as a mother to know that your children were learning history from white South African textbooks?
Yes, and I really did my best to subvert that whenever I could, obviously. I mean, I learned it myself and I had one teacher who was very good at pointing out the iniquities of what we were learning. But sure, it was difficult, and it's not only the textbooks; it's the invidious type of indoctrination.
What's an example of the kind of indoctrination you felt you were exposed to?
You mean when I was at school?
Yeah,
yeah. Well, it was in a history course. One thought that the world and South Africa began in 1652 when the Dutch settlers arrived from Europe. If one delved any deeper, you know, it was severely discouraged and almost one could be excommunicated. So there was that sort of approach. The whole bias was written from the point of view of the Afrikaners, whether it was through any of the wars, through any of the great discoveries, through any of the industrial enterprises. It was always from an Afrikaner bias, and then very much from a Christian and national bias as well. Which is part of the indoctrine, the three legs of the Afrikaner indoctrination technique.
You explained to us a little earlier that although you always opposed apartheid, you didn't want to spend your life in prison and that you didn't plan on becoming a radical. As a liberal, I'm sure the government still saw you as a threat. Were there any reprisals against you?
Yeah, from when I embarked public life, when I took office, and even years before that, I mean, I'm talking now from about the beginning of the 70s, it was almost an everyday occurrence to have some sort of phone call, either a threatening phone call or a so-called dirty phone call related to the work that I was doing. I did receive numerous letters threatening my life and threatening my children's lives. And there was the type of things that happened to friends of mine and colleagues who worked alongside me, tires slashed at night, bullet holes in windows, a more extreme manifestation being pets found skinned on doorsteps. So that sort of thing was just part of the daily life of being a white liberal.
Did that have anything to do with your decision to leave?
Not that per se. Shortly before, we had already started making up our minds to leave South Africa, and shortly after I had been very active in a campaign against the new constitution in 84, and had been part of the founding movement of the UDF, the United Democratic Front, I was visited by the security police who wanted to ask me certain questions about my car, whether my car had been stolen. When I said no, it hadn't, they said, well, this car has been seen at these various addresses. And so I said, yes, well, I was there with my car at those addresses. You know, anything wrong with that? And they said, no, but there may be someday. And I got the message. I also know that my phone was tapped for years and years and years and years. So that sort of surveillance is really wearying. One gets worn down by it. And I always remember the feeling of relief and freedom when I came out of South Africa, when we went overseas to Europe or England or the States. You can almost hit your head on a tree because you can just feel the difference in the air. And I just think that I'd reached a point where I really deep down believed I'd done all I could. I was not prepared to be violent, to take revolutionary action. And I just felt that I could do more out of the country, exposing apartheid in the way I knew it and bearing witness to it, than I could in the country.
Now that you're living in Boston, are you still trying to do work to oppose apartheid in your home country?
Yeah, I'm constantly in touch with people in the grassroots, particularly in the labor movement, which, because of my work on the Johannesburg City Council, became a real interest of mine. I do a lot of writing for various intelligence reports on South Africa, on labor relations. And the speaking that I do is about South Africa and the way I saw South Africa. You know, hopefully this book will show people, fill a gap that I think I don't think there has been a book covering the sort of story that that I give. And I think that the response so far is that, in fact, I have achieved that people do feel that I've filled in areas of knowledge that we're not in touch with before.
Well, I want to thank you for sharing some of your story with us. Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
My guest has been Janet Levine, and her new memoir is titled Inside Apartheid, One Woman's Struggle in South Africa. It's published by Contemporary Books. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Next time, I'll speak with tennis pro Arthur Ashe, and he won some of the most coveted championships in tennis, but his career was cut short when he suffered a heart attack at the age of 36. He's now a writer and has just finished a 3-volume history of the Afro-American athlete. It's called A Hard Road to Glory. I hope you can join us.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Journalist Jane Kramer says she's happiest when she feels like a foreigner. Kramer splits her time between the U.S. and Europe, writing the Letter from Europe column for the New Yorker magazine. Those columns have just been published in a new collection called Europeans. Coming up, we talk with Jane Kramer. Also, rock critic Ken Tucker reviews the new album from Sonic Youth, a band he says is blurring the distinctions between commercial-sounding hard rock and the most extreme sorts of avant-garde music. And film critic Stephen Schiff reviews Dangerous Liaisons, a story of sexual treachery starring Glenn Close and John Malkovich as scheming 18th century aristocrats. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
This is Brian Naylor. Independent counsel Lawrence Walsh today asked the judge in the Iran-Contra case to dismiss the two principal charges against retired Marine Colonel Oliver North. Walsh told the court he was forced to make the decision because of the government's refusal to declassify the documents necessary to prosecute the case. More from NPR's Jim Angle.
Walsh ran into a brick wall in his effort to prosecute North for defrauding the government and theft of government property. The charges that dealt with the sale of weapons to Iran and the diversion of profits from those sales to the Nicaraguan Contras. Walsh said he was forced to take today's action because North requested so many documents for his defense and because U.S. intelligence agencies would not declassify the information. Walsh bowed to the inevitable and decided to ask the judge to dismiss two key counts of the 14-point indictment against North. Walsh told Attorney General Richard Thornburgh yesterday of his decision, but did not ask Thornburgh to take any further action to declassify the documents. 12 charges remain against North for obstruction of Congress, taking gratuities, and false statements to the Congress and government officials. If convicted, he could still face up to 60 years in prison and fines of up to $3 million. An administration source said Walsh told the Attorney General he is confident the remaining charges can be prosecuted speedily and successfully. I'm Jim Angle in Washington.
The Reagan administration says Libya lied when it claimed that its jets shot down by Navy F-14s yesterday were on reconnaissance flights. Citing a videotape taken by one of the F-14s, the Pentagon says at least one of the Libyan MiGs was armed with missiles. The UN Security Council is meeting in an emergency session with Libya seeking condemnation of the U.S. action. Since the U.S. can exercise its veto over Security Council resolutions, passage of such a resolution is unlikely. Federal regulators said today that U.S. banks are unlikely to fail because of their billions of dollars of bad loans to less developed countries. Previously, those loans had been viewed as a serious threat to the stability of the U.S. banking system. NPR's John Idsty has more.
Bank regulator William Seidman, chairman of the FDIC, told the House Banking Committee today that the threat from third world loans has diminished because the amount of the loans has fallen from its peak of $90 billion in 1982 to $76 billion today. In addition, Seidman said, major banks have accumulated loss reserves of $21 billion to protect them from the effect of defaults.
At this time, although this is a serious problem and may affect bank profits, failures due to LCC debt are not likely.
Although other bank regulators at the Treasury Department and Federal Reserve generally agree with Seidman, the General Accounting Office does not. The GAO says the banks and the regulators continue to overvalue the third world loans, and the GAO says the banks need to put aside an additional $28 billion in loan loss reserves to handle potential defaults. I'm John Idsty in Washington.
Defense Secretary Frank Carlucci announced his support today of a plan to close dozens of military bases across the country.
Base closures are long overdue. The department has wanted to close bases for many years to help strengthen the national defense and save money.
But the base closings, if approved by Congress, won't come cheaply. Carlucci said he will ask lawmakers for $500 million in fiscal year 1990 and another $500 million the following year to help cover the expenses of the base closings. The base closing package would shut down 34 military installations and 52 housing complexes. Five other facilities would be partially closed, and 54 others would get new missions or additional personnel. All told, the closings would save $693 million a year. It's now up to Congress to approve the package as a whole or turn it down. Stock prices were higher today on Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrial Average rose more than 12 points to close at 2190.54. This is National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. The British magazine New Musical Express has for several years voted Sonic Youth the best rock band in the world. The band's four members got together in New York in 1981 and have been making music that is loud and literary ever since. Rock critic Ken Tucker has a review of their new album, Daydream Nation. From it, a song called Total Trash.
It started the top. Now it's spiraling down. Where's the best when it's lost? Digging under the ground. Never mind it now. We can bring it back. It's total trash. And it's a natural fact that I'm not no cow.
One of the last first-rate rock albums to be released in 1988 was Sonic Youth's Daydream Nation, a dense double album that I'm only now fully absorbing and appreciating. Sonic Youth is one of those bands that's been so extensively championed, so exhaustively written about, that you begin to suspect its cult status. It's not inappropriate to ask, if they're that good, why aren't they more popular? Well, there's one short but fairly accurate answer to that, because they're rather noisy and perplexing in a way that even loud rock and roll usually is not. That's Hey Joni. Daydream Nation is comparable to the Rolling Stones' Exile on Main Street, another double album that places a high value on murkiness, gallows humor, and a palpable sense of dread. Sonic Youth tries to bypass the dead end of conventional rock lyrics in favor of recurring phrases that operate like incantations. If the language sometimes sounds spacey, that's because one big influence on this band is science fiction, in particular, two forms of it, the tough guy chilliness of cyberpunk and the thickly detailed hallucinations of the author Philip K. Dick, who was thanked specifically for his inspiration on the band's 1987 album, Sister.
I grew up in a shotgun row, sliding down a hill. I fought with the big machines. Still and rusty now, I guess. I back with the river, and that big sign on the road, that's where it all started. Come on down in the store. You can buy us some more.
That's The Sprawl. The song title is taken from a term used in the recent science fiction writing of cyberpunk authors such as William Gibson and Bruce Sterling, and refers to a future controlled by a vast network of computers. In interviews, Sonic Youth bassist Kim Gordon has said that what the band likes about this sort of writing is the way it blurs distinctions between, quote, a dream state and waking life. This idea finds its parallel in Sonic Youth's music in that much of the time distinctions are blurred between accessible, commercial-sounding hard rock and the most extreme sorts of avant-garde music. One way the band achieves this is by using eccentric guitar tunings. Band member Thurston Moore has said, "Our feeling is that guitars are very much unlimited instruments, and it's limited notions of their scope that's made them what they are. When you're playing in standard tuning all the time, you're sounding pretty standard." No one will ever accuse Sonic Youth of playing standard rock and roll.
My head's on straight, my brain.
this talk about the avant-garde and eccentricity, there's no doubt that Daydream Nation must strike longtime Sonic Youth fans as containing the group's most accessible music to date. In rock world terms, this is supposed to mean that the band has sold out in a shameless attempt to reach a larger audience. But such accusations are meaningless in the late 80s, when everything from David Byrne's art songs to the Bulgarian state radio and television female vocal choir are enjoyed by what is in every sense a mass audience. As we move into the 90s, it's becoming clear that Sonic Youth is a cult band more than capable of accommodating a mass following.
Ken Tucker writes about popular culture for the Philadelphia Inquirer.
Everybody's talking about the stormy weather. What's a man to do but work out weather? Looking for a man with a focus and a temper who can open up a map and see between one and two.
That's Sonic Youth, and this is Fresh Air. For the past 10 years, New Yorker writer Jane Kramer has been sending home reports from Europe. She writes the Letter from Europe feature. Some of her reports have been collected in the new book Europeans, which has been nominated for a National Book Critics Circle Award. Her pieces range from a portrait of a West African musician playing Afropop in France to how life in Berlin is affected by the wall. Kramer divides her time between Paris and New York, where her family lives. I asked her how she got to Europe in the first place.
I first got to Europe to work because my husband was brought up in Europe, basically, and missed it so much that the minute we got married, we started spending as much time as possible away from New York. That was really how I started going to Europe. I had been to Europe several times before, but I really started living there a good deal of the time once I married, simply because I married someone who was half European.
Where is your husband from?
Well, he's from this country, but his father was Italian and he was brought up in Switzerland, so he's very Europe-centered. He works here. I'm very American-centered and I work there. We've introduced each other in a way.
When you got to Europe and you started writing stories there, did you feel that there were ways in which Europe had been written about that no longer seemed to fit the new Europe?
Yes, I did. The new Europe, but also journalism at this point in time in America. The news that I read from Europe was macro news by and large. So much of it was under official umbrella, so much of it was political in a very narrow sense that I felt first of all any conventional way of writing would just be duplicating what many other people did, and I also felt there was, I guess, yes, a need for the kind of work I was interested in. As a writer, writing nonfiction, Europe seemed to be a wonderful place to be for someone interested in narrative, for someone interested in people, for someone interested in ordinary life and the texture of ordinary life.
I think probably one of the greatest changes you've seen in your years writing about Europe is the diversification of the European culture through all the new immigrants who have moved into European countries. The impression I have from your book is that there have been two different effects on European culture. One is this real excitement over the diversification of food and music and culture and clothing, but that at the same time it's bringing out a xenophobia. In your previous book, Unsettling Europe, you wrote that the French are thinking less about the problems immigrants have in being poor, foreign, and away from home than about the probability of immigrants being criminals. Is that the case that the new immigrants in Europe are bringing out both this excitement about diversification of culture and xenophobia at the same time?
There's terrible xenophobia, as you probably know right now. It had, in a way, less to do with the fact of immigration, I think, than the fact of Muslim immigration in France. France recruited these workers desperately in the pre-oil crisis days of French economic boom. Suddenly, France wakes up in a terrible economic crisis and discovers that 5 million foreigners are there, many of whom are Arab, and all of those Arabs are Muslim, basically. But as the racism mounted in France, the Muslim fundamentalists came into the towns and the workers' communities where the Arabs were living and began to recruit on the terror of these migrant workers and began to play on their sense of separation and isolation and loneliness and the fact of being threatened and despised, so that there was, to a large extent, what the French call an antichrist, a fundamentalist reaction on the part of those North African immigrants, which in turn fed the xenophobia, which in turn fed the reaction, till you reached a point last year where there were violent crimes in almost every city, and in the large cities of the South, which are often now as much as 25% foreign, the xenophobia has become almost out of bounds.
It's really such an interesting phenomenon that so many of the third world countries that were colonized by Europe and by England and France, now people from those countries are moving into Paris and London, and it's causing such a change in the climate of those cultures.
Totally. And those cultures are transformed by the entry of the old colonized into the metropole. It's part of the shock you feel now when you're a part of that confrontation has to do not just with the crowding in of immigrants or cultural clash, but with a real frustration that's been basically unacknowledged, I think, on the part of all these old colons. There is nowhere to go in Europe, a small continent with hundreds of millions of people who have lost a frontier to themselves. There's no way to solve right now some of the shock of that loss to Europeans.
Well, you get to see also how Europeans see American culture mm-hmm. through, for instance, all the American TV shows that are on mm-hmm. in Europe, American records that are popular in Europe. Have you found anything amusing about the way, for instance, the French relate to American popular culture?
The French love America. The French have a terrific fantasy about America. Their primary fantasy is really cowboy America, which
I thought it was detective America.
No, it's cowboy America. This is why Reagan was not as cynically treated in Europe as I certainly would have expected. And this may have something to do with what we were talking about before. The idea of the frontier, the idea of the cowboy figure, even as fraudulently as that, is so exciting to Europeans. You go into the countryside in France and as close to Paris as Versailles, you will come on dude ranches and Western clothing stores are all over the place. The thing that shocks Europeans, I know, when they come here precisely because of this romance with America is the poverty, is the mm-hmm. the fact of homelessness here has stunned Europeans, I know, coming here. And I say, come on, don't you read your own newspapers? Don't you watch your own television? Don't you see what's happening in America? And they say, yes, but we don't believe it until we come because the country seems so vast and so promising still.
Do you believe it when you come home? When you come home to Manhattan and see the extent of homelessness, are you shocked?
I'm shocked each time because I become very European when I'm away. And the hardest thing for anyone who covers Europe to talk to Americans about or write to Americans about is the social contract in Europe, the fact that life for most people is better in Europe, not because Europe is richer, which it basically is not, or because Europe has better governments, which it does or does not according to the politics of the moment, but because somehow Europeans have learned to live with an appropriate sense of the social cost of human cruelty. There is not much homelessness in Europe. The meaning of civilization to many Europeans now involves the taking care of people within their world. And one of the great myths of America, it seems to me, is the idea that American working people have, that they have the best possible life or in the best possible place, because in Europe it becomes clearer and clearer that the life is saner and better for a working person. That really is stunning to me, continually stunning to me.
Are you going to continue to divide your time between New York and Paris?
Oh, yes. or I'm probably addicted to it in a way. Now I'm here for too much time, and I begin to miss, especially miss my daily life in France. Daily life in Paris is the pleasantest life in the world and the most reviving. So in a sense, I've almost become an addict to this double life.
Well, thanks for telling us a little bit about your double life. Thank you for being with us.
Well, thank you very much.
Jin Cramer's book, Europeans, is published by Farrar, Straus, and Giroux. This is Fresh Air. Alex Chadwick is joining us from Washington, D.C. with a preview of All Things Considered. Alex, what stories are you following?
Terry, our lead story tonight is about the special prosecutor, Lawrence Walsh, who's conducting the criminal investigations of the Iran-Contra affair. He's moving today to dismiss two of the principal charges against Lieutenant Colonel Oliver North, the former National Security Advisor, dismissing them because, he says, the Reagan administration is refusing to release secret documents, which Colonel North says that he needs in his defense. So that's our lead story.
What do you have on the Libya story?
We're going to try to tell the chronology of the event, of exactly what happened in the shootdown of those two Libyan planes yesterday, and cover the press conference that went on today at the Pentagon.
Thanks, Alex. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. The new movie, Dangerous Liaisons, is the story of sexual treachery in the French aristocracy on the eve of the French Revolution. It's directed by Stephen Frears, who also directed My Beautiful Laundrette, Sammy and Rosie Get Laid, and Prick Up Your Ears. Stephen Schiff has a review.
Dangerous Liaisons has all the trappings of an Oscar-hungry prestige picture. An 18th-century setting, period costumes and furnishings, a whisper of Gluck opera on the soundtrack, and a distinguished source, Les Liaisons Dangereuses, the 1782 epistolary novel by Choderlos de Laclos. But the movie is much darker and more disturbing than prestige pictures generally manage to be. It has real heat and real venom, and it succeeds where so many films in the era of AIDS have failed. It gives eroticism its proper weight. In other words, it makes sex look dangerous again. With the writer Christopher Hampton, who adapted his own successful stage play, the director Stephen Frears has reinvented the aristocracy on the verge of the French Revolution. He imagines it as a class of extraordinarily vigorous and sophisticated people who pour their talents and energies into social strategies, as though social relations were politics or war. The highest stakes involve seduction and sexual reputation, and the masters of seduction are the Marquise de Merteuil, played by Glenn Close, and the Count de Valmont, played by John Malkovich. The game begins when these two make an unholy wager.
No, I think you should organize an infidelity. With me, for example.
You refuse me a simple favor, then you expect to be indulged?
It's only because it is so simple it wouldn't feel like a conquest. I have to follow my destiny. I have to be true to my profession.
All right, then. Come back when you've succeeded with Madame de Tourvel.
Yes.
And I will offer you a reward.
During the course of the movie, Valmont succeeds in seducing the virginal but avid Cécile Volange, well played by Uma Thurman. and then the virtuous and loyally married Madame de Tourvel, with whom he also, unfortunately, falls in love. Tourvel is played by Michelle Pfeiffer, in a performance that's so luminous and unaffected that her resultant undoing has the force of tragedy. But the casting of the two central villains is somewhat less successful. As Mertoy, Glenn Close is effectively regal and ruthless, but she also does an awful lot of wicked witch posturing that sends her performance careering over the top. As Valmont, John Malkovich is over the top too, in ways that are fascinating at first, but eventually drive you buggy. Valmont need not be physically attractive to be a master of seduction, but Malkovich makes himself so repugnant that he turns the movie on its ear. And his hoity-toity airs are charmless and miscalculated. He seems not only to disdain his victims, but also to disdain seduction and copulation themselves. And though a great artist may despise his audience, he can never despise his art. These casting anomalies, along with some bad screenwriting and a series of fuzzy-headed plot twists during the final 15 minutes, blunt the movie's force, but they can't destroy the air of malignancy and horror that Frears creates with his elegantly gliding camera, his fleet cutting, and his use of wintry natural light that freezes his subjects beneath their powder and rouge. Dangerous Liaisons isn't perfect, and you could never call it fun, but it's a brilliant tarantella of a movie, a swift, graceful spider's dance.
Stephen Schiff is critic at large for Vanity Fair and is a contributing correspondent to West 57th. Here's a look at the next Fresh Air. Next time, we meet dancer and choreographer Bella Lewitsky, one of the West Coast pioneers of modern dance. Now Lewitsky is preparing to open the most comprehensive dance complex in the U.S., located in Los Angeles. New Orleans pianist Mac Rebenack is back in our weekly performance spot, playing tribute to James Booker. And critic-at-large Laurie Stone reviews Jay Leno, both as a stand-up comic and as a talk show host. So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who makes Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Phyllis Myers, Amy Sallet, and Naomi Person. Production assistants from Lisa Bruton and Deborah Beagle. Research assistants from Tim Jacoby. Our engineer is Thad Kirk. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.